Tell me, what's your lofty mission in life that lets you sneer at my humble profession?
Well, I'm an actress.
What?
On the stage.
Oh, on the stage. Well, I'd like to see you act. What are you in right now? I could brush up on my English or bring along an interpreter. That is, if they'd let in a movie actor.
Well, I'm not in a play right now, but I will be. I'm going to New York.
Oh, you're going to New York. And then someday we'll all hear of you, won't we? Kathy Sheldon as Juliet, as Lady Macbeth, as King Lear. You'll have to wear a beard for that one, of course.
Oh, you can laugh if you want to, but at least the stage is a dignified profession. And what have you got to be so conceited about? You're nothing but a shadow on film. A shadow. You're not flesh and blood.
The movie speaks.
Welcome back, listeners. This is another episode of Let the Movie Speak. My name is Travis.
And I'm Justin.
Still Justin.
As usual. Well, the show's not over. But as of right now, at the beginning, coming out of my wigwam, taking a look around, ready to go. I'm Justin.
All right, Justin. Nice to have you back with us. Today, it's been a while since we've gotten to tap our little toesies, Justin, to a musical. It is 1952. Excuse me. I got it confused with the other musical that it followed, also starring Gene Kelly. 1952's Singing in the Rain. I'm really excited to talk about this movie because Justin, it's just kind of an exciting movie. It's fun.
It's a kick in the pants or a tappity in the toes, if you prefer.
And I do.
So put on your tap shoes if you have them, because you're gonna want to be tap dancing your pants off by the end if you're anything like us.
Yeah. Well, it's a podcast, so you can tap dance your pants off. No one will care. Let's take a little stock of where we're at here. We're halfway after today, Justin, through
the
50s.
We've made it.
Yes.
Yep, 6 episodes in. That means 6 to go.
That...
because 6 plus 6 is 12.
You're right. You're smart.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I still think we have some potential really good stuff coming up in the future, but like, I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
We've had some more, more hit and miss decade, at least choices. Again, this is not, we select the movies, and there's lots of other movies in the 30s and 40s and time travel and heist movies, of course. But like, we're hitting more than we're missing this time around, in my mind, Justin.
I agree with you, partner. I hope that continues. I can't remember it right at the moment, you know, the complete repertoire of what's left for this season. But yeah, I would say at this point we're kind of 6 for 6 in my mind.
Yeah. I didn't love High Noon like it maybe in to the same degree that you did, but certainly things to appreciate
sure.
There. And we've got a couple sci-fis coming up. Which is kind of fun.
That's true, we do.
Yeah.
Yes, The Forbidden Planet is one of them, I think.
Yes. And
Some Like It Hot is the other sci-fi movie.
Yeah, there's several aliens in Some Like It Hot. The aliens do not, in fact, like it hot. That's their demise. Sorry, spoiler
alert.
That's
the twist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it should be a fun rest of the series. Quick reminder, because we haven't done this in a while, you should share... if you are listening to this show and you are enjoying it on Instagram or on Twitter or on Facebook or wherever your social media lands, share something. Like, subscribe, share. That's what people like to say. And it will really help.
Don't
the
they
show
usually out. Say smash the subscribe
smash
button?
Smash that subscribe button, which I
sounds
mean,
violent.
Yeah. And my phone, I mean, I don't know if I have an old model, but like, there's no subscribe button on here, so I don't. Maybe that's the problem.
That's a problem.
Yeah,
you got to get that looked at.
Yeah. Anyway, should we talk about what we watched this week so we can get into it?
Yes, we should.
You're right. Okay, you ambushed me. I think at least 2 weeks in a row. So I'm gonna take this.
Are you getting wise to my tactics?
Take this soggy umbrella and chuck it back in your direction. What did you watch this week, Justin?
Well, wiping the water off of my face, I hope that's water. It's vodka, maybe. What are you drinking,
that's
sir?
From the Russian version of Singing in the Rain. Yeah.
Yeah, the Singing in the Vodka. Showed them. Actually, it was Singing in the Tequila.
Okay.
It was they were going multicultural with that Russian production. anyway, I watched, well, now I have watched both Paddington and Paddington 2.
Oh, boy.
So, have you seen either of these?
Yes. Didn't I recommend Paddington 2 to you? I could have sworn that I did.
I don't think so. I don't think anyone had.
Dude.
If you did, I must apologize because I didn't remember that.
Yes, I've seen them both. I saw the first one just at home with the kids, and the second one, I took my kids to the drive-in, and we saw it, and it was a blast.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that we have the same takeaway then. I, of course, watched these with the whole family.
Uh-huh.
Actually, I was trying to watch it by myself, and my wife said, "Why are you hiding in our bedroom in the dark?" And I was like, "Paddington's on. Quiet. Bring me my duffel coat.
Bring me a piece of toast with marmalade on it and quit your questioning."
Yeah, and she was like, "You know what? I think for many reasons this would be better if we did this as a whole family." And so
we haven't seen you in 3 days, Justin. Come watch Paddington with your family.
Right. It was just on repeat. It was kind of a sick thing. I'm in therapy. Don't worry. These are both really fun movies, and I think that they succeed. If you had to try to boil it down to its essence, Paddington and Paddington 2 succeed because they capture Michael Bond's his idea, his concept, and the tone of his books. And they translate it really well to screen so that what you're seeing is a fully realized, it's a unique, wonderful, zip-zapping little world where you get stuff that is not in the books, but that feels like it is totally in tune with. I'm talking about the Latin jazz band that follows Paddington around.
Of course.
That's, of course, right up your alley.
In both movies, which I loved seeing in the second one. I was like, I was not expecting them to bring that back. And then they just like are there on a street corner or when he's washing windows. And I was like, oh, they're back. Yes. Yeah. It was so good.
Yeah. And in other, you know, things just like in the first movie, there's the whole plot that features the explorer that's come to Darkest Peru to find Paddington's, you know, relatives, which is sort of done as a prologue to the movie in black and white and filmed, presented as a documentary.
Right.
And the humor in there is just so great. I mean, it's very British, but in a very accessible way. I mean, these were both huge commercial successes when they came out, even in the States. So there's something it manages to be very British, and yet it is really accessible for anyone that has a funny bone, I think. They're both just a delight, and casting has a lot to do with that. Sally Hawkins, Hugh Bonneville,
so good.
Nicole Kidman is the bad guy in the first one, and Hugh Grant is the sort of bad guy in the second one. These movies are great. Oh, and what's his name? Who's the guy, Travis, that plays Knuckles McGinty? The guy from In Bruges. Brendan Gleeson.
Ray Winston? No, that's the other guy. Brendan Gleeson.
Isn't it Brendan Gleeson?
I always get Ray Winston and Brendan Gleeson mixed up because they're like the American and British counterpart of each other.
That is a really interesting observation. I would love to see some kind of, like, there's definitely a mob movie to be made.
Yes.
You know?
Where they're
my Irish cousin.
They're each the head of a different mob family, and they have to kill each other. Because like they're both like portly character actors who have amazing voices and like sunken eyes and just jowls for days. Yeah, yeah. I love them both.
Yeah.
But yeah, Brendan Gleeson as Knuckles McGinty, right? Is that his name?
Yes, Knuckles McGinty. So good. What a great... Yeah, I mean, the movie just gets away... And the tone is so unique. It is so just like, we're in a Paddington movie now. Like this... These are not the laws of the universe we live in, but in the laws of the Paddington world, this is what's happening. Like, how about in the second movie, the warden, after Paddington has helped out in the kitchen for a while and everyone's eating good, the warden says at night, one night, "Well, they're not up to anything here. I guess I'll go home." And it's like, wow, this is just, this is its own thing. Really a delight. So if you haven't seen him, especially if you've got kids, check him out. Everyone's going to like him. And you too can hide out in your bedroom for days on end with just a copy of Paddington and a triple D-celled battery powered flashlight. Anyway, Travis, what'd you watch?
I'll tell you what I watched. I just want to say two more things about Paddington 2, which is the Hugh Grant performance cannot be oversold. Like, it is so freaking good. And I wish I would have gone first today, because mine is not going to be nearly as good of a segue into Singing in the Rain. But Hugh Grant's performance in Paddington 2 is an epic segue into Singing in the Rain, because he has gone full vaudeville musical guy. Like, he is so freaking funny, and he looks like you plucked him out of 1950 out of like a movie music.
He totally does.
It's seriously like Oscar worthy. I don't know why it didn't get any like weird buzzy supporting actor, like, because it's so, so good. And also, Paddington 2 is gorgeous. Like, if you just are a movie nerd and you don't have kids, or like you just appreciate well-constructed things, like, I'm just thinking about like the color palette in that movie, when like all of the prisoners get their uniforms dyed pink.
Right.
And then the prison looks insane, but in a really cool way. And the storybook, like, animation stuff, the pop-up books. This stuff is like, so it's like Spielberg level genius of visuals.
Right.
So I cannot recommend Paddington 2 highly enough. Yeah.
To help us segue into that, Travis, why don't you talk about your movie and then desperately try to bring up Hugh Grant, especially his musical number, like in the end credits.
Oh my gosh.
And if that doesn't work, I will come with a tow hook and we'll grapple it together and pull it in.
Well, grapple, Justin, grapple. You just got us to my movie, because the movie that I watched this week is something that so I teach high schoolers for a living. That's my job. And you didn't know this?
Who are you?
I'm sorry. I just do. And anyway, I often have conversations with my students about, like, hey, what do you guys watch? You know, what are you enjoying on movies or TV or whatever? And for like the last however long, 6-8 months or whatever, this movie's been out, the one movie that I hear more often than not, like, have you seen this? Have you seen this? Is Matt Reeves's The Batman. And every time, I come across this conversation, whether it's with an adult or with one of my students, it's like, I feel this weight of like, this is a culturally important thing. Like, this is such a hit. We love this so much. This is our Batman. This is, you know, whatever the thing is. Right. And so forever and ever, I was just like, I told you on this podcast, I'm done with superhero movies for a while. I can't do it. I'm tapping out. It was after Zack Snyder's Justice League months and months and months ago. And it's like, it's on HBO Max and it's just sitting there, and I did not, in fact, see the runtime before I pressed play on this stinking movie. It is 2 hours and 50 minutes long.
Oh my goodness. It's longer than The Sound of Music.
What is wrong with these DC movies that they can't just make a 2-hour movie or something? Like, it is bananas to me.
Your movie, don't you feel like, Travis, as a general rule,
yeah,
if your feature length movie is rivaling The Godfather Part 2's runtime, be really careful. Be really careful where you stand.
If you're not depicting a war or like a period epic that takes place over a decade, then why are we here for 3 hours? It's almost unjustifiable. It really is.
Oh boy.
Yeah. I mean,
I feel like what you're about to say is not going to be a plot twist, Travis. I feel like it's just going to get worse.
No, I can honestly say I hated everything about this movie. Like, like, with no reservations.
Good.
I wanted to like something about it, because I was like, I guess I'm putting in almost 3 hours. So maybe here's what I'll say. Like, I like Batman movies more than other superhero movies in general. There are more good Batman movies than any other like series of superhero movies.
It's probably true.
Yeah. I mean, I like the Tim Burtons a lot. You know, I find the Schumachers to be in the so bad it's kind of fun category, because they're just absolutely insane. Bat skates and bat nipples, anyone?
I'll take bat nipples for 200.
Yeah, it's an entire category about bat nipples. do they have a lactation feature? Okay, moving on. The Nolans are good, right? Like, by and large, like Batman Begins is pretty good, and Dark Knight is a good flick, and Rises has some good stuff in it, at least, and it's like a well put together movie by and large. You know, it's Nolan, so there's attention to detail. But like, I'll just be as fast as possible because I'm probably the last person in the world who is going to watch this movie who finally did. And I don't like the Batman. The Batman is an emo, like just purely brooding and almost no humanity in this character. Like, so there's nothing to attach yourself to because he's just playing the tortured underbelly part of Batman. It's a huge bummer. I think their villains are the weakest of like most Batman movies I've seen. Like they're
wow.
This movie opens with like a vivid, somewhat realistic Riddler murdering someone by bludgeoning them over the head and duct taping their face closed, you know, full of duct tape.
Riddle me this. How did he die? That's the riddle. After he, yeah.
It was anyway, the bludgeoning, I think. Yeah. And so like it definitely is like, it's a director who I've liked in the past. Like Matt Reeves did like Cloverfield and I think a couple other things that I've thought were good. And
didn't he do one of the Planet of the Apes movies too?
Oh, I think he did more than one, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah.
Maybe he did the last two of that trilogy.
There you go. Yeah, and I thought those were good. Like I thought all three of those were interesting, at least. The villain is... It's like if you took the dark, gritty, quote-unquote realism of the Nolan Batman and you just like cranked that into the world of like David Fincher 7 and Zodiac and like it's just like it's a
that's
freaking
not a good combo, Travis.
It's a freaking gross movie. Like there's no everybody's gross. Batman's kind of gross and the Riddler is so gross and the like romantic tension between him and yet another Catwoman is like it feels lurid and weird and not at all rooted in real relationship, but just rooted in like animalistic, like urge. It's just, it's a gross movie. I think the Penguin is played by what Colin Firth and like heavy prosthetic and
Colin Farrell.
Colin Firth.
That might have saved the movie.
He would belong in Paddington somewhere, right? If he's not in it, right? Yeah, he almost seems like he should be in it. I did not enjoy the Batman. It's a long movie. It is so punishing. Like it's not enjoyable. There's nothing fun in the Batman. And you know what? It's freaking Batman and he has grappling hooks and he spreads his wings and flies at one point and he does a car chase, but not a single bit of it was like, oh, this is a fun part. No, none of it was fun. And,
okay, Travis, I'm so excited because I think I know how to get us back. How to segue. Okay. I saw an interview, and I think I may have told you about this before.
Uh-huh.
An interview, actor on actor, Hugh Grant and Colin Farrell. And they were talking about what kind of movies they like to do. And Colin Farrell was kind of, he did not sound like a tool or anything, okay? But he was kind of bemoaning, like, man, how do you, like, I really struggle with, like, doing projects where I know I gotta, like, put food on the table, but then I want to do a project just because it, like, seems like a good movie and I want to be involved with it.
Yeah.
And so he's kind of burying his soul a little bit, and Hugh Grant's just kind of looking at him like, I'm listening. And then when Colin Farrell makes his point, Hugh Grant just kind of answers simply, kind of with a smile on his face, a little bit with an expression that says, what are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
He says, well, at the end of the day, we're just actors.
Yeah.
People just want to see us act. So I just think it's great that we get to do this.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes through pretty freaking loud and clear when he is dancing down the steps the prison in the end of Paddington 2. Just like Donald O'Connor, Debbie Reynolds, and Gene Kelly in Singin' in the Rain.
I especially appreciated how you did the title of the movie in your Batman voice to tie everything. It's like a perfect braid of a segue. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
So Singin' in the Rain is nothing like 2022's The Batman because it's a super fun movie. It's a 1952 movie musical starring Gene Kelly, also co-directed by Gene Kelly. And we can get more into that.
And choreographed by...
Gene Kelly.
That's what happens when I interrupt you.
No, that's perfect.
It's all a smooth sailing ship over here, folks.
Stick to the script, Justin. And Stanley Donen, who was a very well-established director at this point. It's written by Betty Comden and Adolph Green. It's honestly probably one of the least important writing credits. And I don't mean that in a mean way, because I think there's some really good writing in this movie. But this is a classic of the era movie musical. So it is bright and colorful and fun and dynamic. And they wrote the entire script after they had already picked the songs. So that's what I mean by that. You've got, Gene Kelly, Donald O'Connor, Debbie Reynolds, and Gene Hagen, who we have seen before, Justin, in a couple flicks.
Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah, and Adam's Rib, if I'm not mistaken, which was a...
Oh, yeah.
A classic. A classic.
We loved it.
Non-funny comedy. Anyway...
It's kind of like the Batman.
Yeah, like the Batman had no jokes. I was really disappointed. People told me it had jokes, dang it. Okay, this movie was nominated.
Did they really? You need to go back and find those people.
Yeah.
And be vengeance.
And kill them with something blunt like the Riddler.
Okay, so I know Singing in the Rain doesn't have anything to do with vengeance, but just Batman real quick. Why is he saying that in so many movies now? Like when I saw that in the trailer that he said, I am vengeance.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, I don't buy that for one. And why is any living actor that's not like portraying Lego Batman saying that? That doesn't seem.
Yeah. Well, because Justin, he is vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
That's why.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, so he is vengeance.
He is vengeance. This movie,
okay.
Singing in the Rain, was nominated for Best Actress in a Supporting Role, Gene Hagen, and Best Music. Shocker there. And it won neither of them. And it was only nominated in those two categories, which is kind of crazy if you have watched this movie.
And I thought it was really interesting to find out this movie was not like a humongous commercial success when it came out.
No, a modest success. Yeah.
It made money, but it wasn't until, I don't know, when was it? The 80s? Later, at a later time. It has started to get the classic status that it now enjoys today.
Yeah, well, I think part of that is we often forget, and I think we talked about this with Frankenstein, because they had those like censorship issues and the reissues and all that stuff. And
right.
People did not have access to this movie after it was out of theaters. It was just in theaters for a while. And they would do re-releases more often back then. Like if a movie did well, they'd give it a few months off and then re-release it and kind of re-advertise it, because that was how they make, you know, a couple extra bucks. But this movie hit television in the 70s. Like I can't remember the exact date, but I read that at some point when I was doing some research. It's like there was a good 20-year period where people did not have access to this movie, and they just either remembered it as, you know, that Gene Kelly flick in theaters, or as I think the Academy kind of remembered this movie, which is the year after follow-up to An American in Paris, another huge Gene Kelly hit that won a ton of Oscars. It was like almost a full sweep, like, you know, Silence of the Lambs style, that won all the majors. It kind of, in a lot of ways, people believe stole the thunder of Singing in the Rain, because it came out just so close that it drew a lot of comparisons. Obviously Gene Kelly is sort of his own bright shining star when he's in a movie. And that has some good effects, which we can talk about. And it also is not the greatest thing in the world if you're working on the film, Justin. I don't know if you read anything about...
So I've heard.
Yeah, anything about Gene Kelly behind the scenes, but we can get into that. So this is a classic now, Justin, wouldn't you say? I mean, it's certainly regarded
unquestionably.
Well. But back then, maybe not quite the smash hit or historical landmark that we think about now, especially in this era of movie musicals. The other thing that is worth mentioning is, I think of all of the 50s movies, even all of the post-war movies, let's just wrap all of that stuff into one that we've covered so far. This is probably the best snapshot of 50s American optimism, or it's a different kind of escapism, right? Because we had the interwar, pre-war, or, you know, during war periods where we were like, yeah, there's escapism in here because people didn't want to think about the horrible things that were happening. Well, now we're post-World War II, And this is different, Justin, in some distinctive ways.
Yeah, it's super colorful. A lot of that, I think, just comes down to aesthetic.
Yeah.
That's at least half of it, right?
Where sure.
This is a big spectacle, like you said. It's beautiful to look at, and yeah. It's just a lot of fun. Like, you know, from the very beginning, the movie very clearly sets up, we're going to take you on a fun ride through the 1920s, through the golden age of Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And you're there. And, I mean, the production is just so fantastic. And, I mean, I love this is definitely the cleanest cut of this movie I've seen.
Yeah.
I also watched this on HBO Max. And, oh, my gosh, dude, I don't know what print they have of this movie, but it's spotless.
Yeah, it looks amazing.
It is so beautiful. So if you get a chance, definitely check it out, at least on there. Throw away your VHS.
Yeah.
Get your Laserdisc of Singing in the Rain out of the rotation and behold it in 4K or what. I don't know what it is.
Yeah.
Just natively what that print is, but it is beautiful. And I think the other part of that is, as a movie, right, so it's presented very beautifully, but the actual, the text of the movie, what is it saying, the kind of question we're interested in answering, I think the answer to that, which is honestly probably more in this movie's favor, is not much.
Mm-hmm.
It's not trying to push any envelopes. It's not trying to get you to think deeply. It's a popcorn, delightful movie, I think, in the best sense.
Yeah.
This is a great example, I think, of how popcorn movie doesn't equal, like, stupid or trash or, you know, somehow lesser art.
Yeah.
You can have something that is beautiful and entertaining. And maybe, what do you think, Travis? For my money, I think that has something to do, too, with that the popcorn entertainment of this is so made real by the fact that it's not CGI, it's not some kind of cheap trick that makes this thing go.
Yeah.
It is the actual human talent of these dancers and these singers.
Yeah,
and
that is
amazing to watch.
It is. And for that reason, Justin, I think the best way to approach talking about this movie as a whole would be to do our What's It Saying section. I'm actually going to just look at the Spotify track list on the soundtrack, and we're going to go through each tune, because this is not a sung through musical, but the songs are what the movie is about. The numbers are what the movie is about. So as we get into What's It Saying, we are just going to look at the track list. How does that sound?
Sounds great.
Okay, so track number one, Justin, which is not the overture, which is pretty. All the orchestrations are nice. Is let's see if you can name them. Maybe we'll play a little name that tune and see how you do. Well, that was kind of cheating because the title was in what they just said.
Yeah, it's either Fit as a Fiddle or Can't Find My
Shoelaces.
Yeah.
Yeah, that,
one of those, Travis.
Classic. Well, there's a big controversy that Fit as a Fiddle was a ripoff of Can't Find My Shoelaces by Bojangles.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Okay, so this is the one where they're in the montage. They're showing them kind of coming up through the showbiz world, and they're doing that insane tap, sing, and play fiddles at the same time, like around each other. We get introduced to our two main dudes, at least. We get introduced to Don Lockwood and Cosmo, and I think right off the bat, what's really good about this movie is the structure and pacing are so freaking tight as a drum. Like, they come walking down the red carpet, and it's a really convenient narrative device to introduce people to the audience, but also it makes sense because this person shoves a microphone in their face and they're like, Don Lockwood, are you and Lee and Lamont going to get married soon? And you're like, okay, these are the big stars. And then you got the friend off to the side, Cosmo. And he says that he's like, you know, I can't talk about my success without having Cosmo mentioned. And then you cut right to this musical number of them coming up together, and you see their, you know, camaraderie and their kind of similar nature of gregarious on stage kind of charisma and all that. And so, like you said, the technicality of the performance is incredible. But also, I think it functions as a good little character introduction. What do you think?
Yep.
Thanks, bud. So you like Fit as a Fiddle as a tune?
I do. I think it's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I think it's probably for me, it's maybe the funniest sequence in there, because So many of the jokes rely, it's funny in a way that is more kind of awe-inspiring, because even if they're not physically playing the fiddle, Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor,
yeah,
it's amazing to watch one hop on the other's back and, yeah, you know, pretend like one is, I mean, there is just, and I don't know if this sequence was, but that most of the portion of that song looks like it's shot as a one take.
Yeah.
Which just, the way that these actors worked, man, on these kind of movies is just second to none.
It's crazy.
It is. They're putting in some real work. So, yeah, I thought the melody was fun. It very much calls, it's very much a 20s or maybe 30s kind of melody, yeah, you know? And I read later that, of course, which you probably already knew, these songs had already all been, well, I guess for like one or two exceptions, these songs were already part of MGM's catalog,
yep,
from the 20s and 30s. And so it's just interesting to me that by the 50s, you know, the 20s is passé. I mean, yeah, if you're going to make a musical today, you're not going to make Kurt Cobain the musical and it sell a lot of tickets,
yeah,
in 2022, you know?
Yeah.
Although perhaps
Kurt Cobain to that point, yeah,
as the Batman. You see where I'm going with,
well,
this?
No, but there
I hear money.
I was not honestly emotionally invested enough in the Batman to know this, but there is some recurring 90s grunge song in that.
Oh, no.
It's in the trailer, too. So you're all, if you, you know, if any of you are listening to this and you're like, no, it's that something in the man. It's like, I know. I just don't care. I just don't care what it
that
is.
That reminds me of the, do you remember that episode of Frasier where they've got the like grunge rocker or something living above them? And
yes,
Daphne and Martin keep running around the house saying, flesh is burning. <Da-na-na-na-na-na>. That's so good.
That's so good.
All right, sorry. Back to Fit as a Fiddle. It's a lot of fun.
Lots of fun.
And it feels, I don't know, just because of the way that vaudeville is presented, you know, it's very nostalgic.
Yes.
And there's nothing overly serious about this movie, and it manages to do that without being completely vapid,
which I think is
a real feat.
Yeah, I think, Justin, that there's movies that shoot for the absolute stars with theme and story and maybe message or whatever, and they get there. And then there's movies that reach for nothing, and we're just like, why does this exist? This is kind of that perfect middle ground of like, everything we're trying to do, we're going to succeed like 100% at, but we're not going to overreach. And so there's stuff in here. There's thematic stuff in here. When we get to other songs, we'll bring it up. But like, yeah, this exists to kind of look back at showbiz from a few years back and be like, oh, look at what this used to look like. And it's kind of goofy. And I think that's kind of okay, you know,
yeah,
and establish, yeah, characters well. Okay, Fit as a Fiddle. We are ready to go on to the next tune. And it sounds like this, Justin. Somebody just popped out of a cake. There's some female choreography happening. This tune is called All I Do Is Dream of You. And yeah, I'm glad you mentioned it because this is kind of a jukebox musical. Like all of these songs were not new other than a couple of them, like you said. This title track, Singing in the Rain, had been used in like three or four movies before this. And then they just decided to make it the big, you know, title number and one of the most iconic sequences. But this sequence involves Debbie Reynolds kind of flashing her expertise for the first time. We get a little introduction scene with them in the car, which is, it's kind of fun, but also there's a bit of commentary in there, right? Like the red carpet sequence and, yeah, the car sequence put together, they at least seek to say like, this guy is so too big for his britches that he, you know, wants to make a quick pass at this woman who he just met 5 seconds ago. And what's really refreshing about this movie is she's like, don't touch me. She has like, right, real like characterization. She's a sane, like rational person. And I like that their relationship is built on him being kind of an ass first. And then she, you know, rejects him for it. And then the way that their relationship blossoms is it comes out of him seeing her like as an actual performer, and then becoming, you know, attracted to her in more than just a surface level way, but in like, oh, I actually, like, after having mocked you for not being as big as I am, I respect your skills. You know, I think there's something to that in this tune. Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there is. And I think maybe part of the reason then this movie does succeed and doesn't fall into the traps of being lesser is that it does, well, with one exception, which maybe we can get into later, most of the characters are treated like characters, you know, not in the sense of like a David Mamet script or something, uh-huh. you know, but just in terms of, like you said, for Debbie Reynolds' character, there's real personality there, you know. It's very not one note. And I don't know. I think it conveys just enough. A modicum of reality that there's more to latch on to there.
Agreed.
I have to say when she came out of the cake and then there's dancing, it was a powerful reminder that shorts tend to be very short for women in these musicals.
And like dancing in general, it's like it's kind of a culture shock. I took my kids to the ballet like three years ago, because they had like a, you know, bring your kids to the ballet for $5, and it was in San Francisco and like a, you know, legit ballet performance of, what was it, Snow White or something like that.
The Batman.
I would legit see a ballet of the Batman. That sounds amazing.
Starts with the Riddler bludgeoning someone to death.
We got to get Sydney back on here and pitch us Batman the ballet. That would be, she would have a good pitch for that, I feel like.
Okay, bring her on. Yeah. Let's get it done.
Bonus episode, dream pitch meetings. No, but like, yeah, you're right. There's like, and I do think them going through the different like venues that they went up through, like vaudeville, burlesque, you know, Follies, all of those different genres did exist pre-1950. And like to varying degrees, they were, you know, flashy or, you know, maybe more suggestive or whatever. And so like, I feel like to properly depict showbiz, I think 42nd Street, which we already talked about, speaking of Sydney, with Sydney on as a guest, these two movies do a good job, I feel like, of representing show business truthfully, even though one of them is kind of darker, more like cynical sort of meditation on showbiz, or like the passing off of careers kind of a thing. And this one is obviously a lot more light and fluffy and whatever. But yeah, the wardrobe or whatever, like you were saying, Justin, is like you go to the ballet and you're like, oh, okay, we'll be having a conversation with the children on the way home on that one. But it's like some of that's just like, okay, you take your kids to an art museum and they're going to see some naked folks. It's just like, that's classic, right. You know, it's par for the course here. I don't know. Yeah. Anyway.
No, I think it's if that has a commentary, I think it's I don't know. Let's see. This is probably way too deep of amusing, but not because I'm deep, but it's just not proper, especially talking about this movie. But I'll go for it anyway. So we've got in just about every musical that I have seen from these decades, 30s, 40s, and 50s, if women are choreographed dancing, you're going to see their legs and like all of them.
Yep.
And then it's like the leg just continues forever. You know, it doesn't terminate in fatal nudity. It just, the leg just goes up
fatal
to the heavens.
Nudity. If you looked at the nudity, you would expire.
It's mortal. Yeah. Anyway, so you, but it's like, wow, they're really, I mean, that is part of what's being sold, right?
Sure.
There is, it's not objectification like pornographic, but
yeah,
it is objectification of a kind.
Yeah.
And it's pretty stark contrast to all the male dancers tend to be like in this movie. Even, you know, if there's a scene where a woman's dancing, there is an exception, but generally if there's a woman dancing, she has revealed at least all of her legs and then probably all of her arms,
right,
and part of her upper body too, and men will be in slacks and like a tuxedo or something. Anyway, that was to just cut everything. If like when you go through and edit this episode, when you hear me start to talk ever, like at second five, I just edit that out.
Okay, this will just be the longest bleep we've ever had. Just bleep. People will think their car stereos have exploded.
Okay. And you'll have a PSA every 10 seconds.
Yeah.
It's fine. Don't turn it off. We just had a slight difficulty. We had a spot of bother with one of the hosts.
Okay.
He's dead.
I do
terminally.
I do think that having her pop out of a cake and then dance in this chorus line with a bunch of girls in their dancer costumes.
Really liked that, huh?
Come on. No, I mean, like, there's some sort of character serving thing there, which is like she's embarrassed, like, immediately to see him at this fancy party, and he's in his tux and she's in her little sort of like plebeian showgirl costume or whatever. And so that that plays into the dynamic a little bit. We'll talk more about those two later. Next tune sounds like this.
Make them laugh, make them laugh. Don't you know everyone wants to laugh?
So this is kind of an all-timer in my mind, Justin, as far as this era, physical comedy, music smashed together, and technical prowess, right? Because you can do some Googling around on the backstory for this song, but basically they just, you know, Donald O'Connor and Gene Kelly just workshopped every little slapstick bit of Make 'Em Laugh together and smashed them all together. So there was just like gag after gag after gag. Donald O'Connor was an incredibly accomplished dancer, which you can tell by watching the movie, but he like almost killed himself. Like, doing this, he was bedridden for 3 days. He had like literal injuries and bruises on his ankles and feet and knees and carpet burns and all this stuff, and he smoked 4 packs of cigarettes a day, and then he did this in one take, only to find out that some cameraman had not checked the aperture on the lenses. So Gene Kelly was like, he came up to him and he was like, Donald, do you think you can do that again? And he was like, I think if you need me to, I think I can. And he said, okay, good, because we lost all of it. And then, you know, like, they had to redo the whole thing even after he almost killed himself.
It was right after Gene Kelly took a gun and murdered that cameraman.
Okay, yeah. Gene Kelly was a terror, tragic, by the way. Yeah, there's some crazy backstage stories about him being really not so nice to everyone, but in particular to Debbie Reynolds, because she was a little more green than the other cast
members.
She
was like 19, wasn't she?
Yeah, she's already been in like 4 movies, but this was her first, like, you know, big time movie with, you know, someone like Gene Kelly in it. So what do you think about Make 'Em Laugh, Justin? Does it make you laugh?
It does, and the technicality, the choreography is just, it's nuts. I remember at one point he does kind of 2 in a row where he runs up a wall and does a backflip.
Yeah.
And one of my kids looked back after the first one. Did you see that? You know, like, couldn't believe that a human being could do that.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, he does it again right after that.
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. So, yeah, I mean, it is. It doesn't matter how old you are or when you're born. The stuff in there is really. I can't imagine, dude, like, trying to, I get winded just looking at that.
Yeah.
It's like, how did anyone do that in one take?
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. I think it leans so heavy on the slapstick that it probably, because he's not like, Donald O'Connor's a funny guy, and he went on to do a lot of funny stuff after this.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently one unfunny talk show. Did you know he had a talk show in 1968?
No.
And it got pulled because it was too politicized. And the studio was furious with him. I would really love, I bet there's like no recordings of that anymore, but man, I would love to see what that was.
It'd probably be a hit today, you know, like.
Yeah, exactly. Like Bill Maher before Bill Maher.
Exactly. Yeah.
So anyway, no, it's fun, but it's, I think because some of the slapstick is not, at least for me, not all of it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
But that is easily overcome by the acknowledgement, like, dude has put in some work to pull this off. And so I think it's just fun to watch, whether or not it's actually funny all the time.
It's fun to watch, and then, like, is this man going to kill himself? Like,
and the answer apparently is almost.
Almost, very close.
They tried.
All right, next tune. Imagine a ladder, Justin, and a beautiful, cloudy, pink backdrop.
Like Jacob's ladder?
No, a different ladder. Fred's ladder.
Okay.
I guess it would be Gene's ladder.
Did you say Fred's ladder? Yeah, I was, man.
No,
Fred. You're going really existential.
Fred was the stagehand, that's all. Okay, this is you. Okay. You Were Meant for Me. This is the one. I mean, other than maybe, you know, like Would You, which is sort of woven into the movie and brought back. But this is the one like out, you know, pure musical moment, starry eyed, two people falling in love, like love song. And the thing that strikes me about it most, Justin, is it looks so freaking good. Like, I don't... You can't describe how, like, doing the, like, backlot-y kind of, like, they move from set to set. Like, it just gives them, like, this amazing blank slate of, like, okay, and this scene will have nothing but this immense pink backdrop with clouds and a ladder and some cool spotlights. And then, like you said, like, it leans on the incredible skills of the performers. So, like, his voice is just, like, butter. It's so good. And... I don't know. I think as Make 'Em Laugh is a little bit on the trite side, even for this movie, this sort of is too, but at the same time, like, it's still nice to look at and listen to.
I agree. And, it does bring you into that kind of immersive you believe. I think it's easy to forget that you're watching a movie when you watch a scene like this. It's easy to believe these are two characters on the back lot, where if you think about this rationally, it's like, okay, there's a set of a lot or a stage maybe that they're on, and you have to think that there's actually like 10,000 people behind the camera just to make this happen. So it's very effective. It's very convincing in bringing you into its illusion.
It's dreamy, you know, it's dreamy in a fun way. And I think it works.
Yeah, like Fred's Ladder.
Like Fred's Ladder. Before we skip right over her, because I don't think she has any real songs in the movie because her voice is terrible. Jean Hagen as Lena Lamont. Let's take a little sidebar and just talk about this really fun, like kind of bombastic performance. I specifically like couldn't stop thinking about her in the Asphalt Jungle, and where she plays like this, you know, kind of damsel in distressy normal noir character. And then in this, she's just so freaking funny, dude. Like there's it's hard to write stupid that well. And I feel like it's not done that often where it's like it's a very smart person wrote this stupid character. And she's played with just really good like instincts and choices. I feel like the scenes that I really like with her are the scene where they're having to shoot the scene together, but they're talking to each other about how much they hate each other. And you know, he's smiling, Gene Kelly's character smiling through his teeth, and he's like, I don't like her half as much as I hate you, you reptile, you know? And then, some of her stupid lines later on in the movie are so funny, like so, so funny.
It does. I think it not only takes a tremendous writer, but it has to be Gene Hagen to play this because her voice is so grating. It's perfectly grating, right? It's not, it doesn't, I don't know, man. It's just, she really nails it. She brings it together and makes it, again, not feel just like completely stupid and not feel like she's just a gag, and yet she does it, and she's very funny. The one thing, if I have a little quibble with this movie, and it's not a big deal, and it doesn't diminish like the you know any of the praise that I've given to this movie, but near the end, when you know the whole it's like okay, Debbie Reynolds' character is gonna, you know, she's the voice because clearly, Gene Hagen's character is, you know, just sounds like this when she talks, you know, it's not fun for anyone to hear. But then she just like turns into this like really grating kind of villain. And, to me, the humor was really sucked out of it became really close to being unenjoyable, to me, just as a whole package, unfortunately, because it just didn't seem necessary for the it was like, why in this movie that is like 7/8 over are we now inventing a villain in some kind of tension here? So I feel like that was again, as we talked about the writing process here, was not not exactly how Shakespeare sat down to write a play.
Right.
That's my real only character complaint. That's my overarching complaint for this movie is just that kind of story decision to turn her into this like bad person at the end, where otherwise she'd been clueless. She has her own foibles and she's completely unaware that she sounds like a talking garbage can. But nevertheless, you know, somehow we needed to make her more evil.
It's like, you know, they have, we think of movies now as mostly happening in kind of three act structures in a lot of ways. And it kind of reeks of like, we got to find some way to tie this all up, and to tie things up, we got to have a bad guy who gets defeated. And so for that reason, they amp up her previous qualities to the point of like, I just don't even buy that she would be, you know, capable enough to do this scheme, you know?
Well, that's exactly right, because in one sense, she's super, like, smart and cunning all of a sudden.
Yeah.
But then at the very end, she's like, I'm going to sing for them. Yeah, I'm going to give them a speech. Yeah. And it's like, what? Are you stupid?
And by the
and that's
end...
Her what, am I dumb?
Yeah. By the end of the movie, I don't care about that, but it is a little bit of a speed bump, like, story-wise.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, next tune.
But Moses, he noses, his toeses aren't roses, as Moses supposes his toeses to be. Moses supposes his toeses are roses, but Moses supposes erroneously. A Moses, a Moses.
All right, so Moses supposes, which is, I think, one of the only original songs to the movie.
Yeah.
Let's just pair this one together with one of the best tunes out of the whole movie, which is this next one.
Good morning.
We've talked the whole night through.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So these two together, which the first one, Moses, takes place in the like diction person's office, and then
diction studio.
Yeah. Thanks, Batman.
Later, Ludacris would cut a diction album in there.
And Good Morning, which is the three of them all together. These are, I think you could argue, and I'm pretty sure one of them said this, Gene Kelly or Donald O'Connor. These are the two like most technically proficient like dance sequences in the movie, because the two guys have to be like in perfect sync for that entire dance for the most part.
Right.
They hop up on a desk, they jump down off the desk. The tapping in this scene is freaking incredible. Like, it is so, so brilliant. And then the dancing in Good Morning ain't too shabby either, Justin. The three of them all together are just like, I was so enraptured by the tap dancing. Like, and I don't fancy myself a like dance like expert or something, but I can see when it's this good, man. And these two together, I really, really enjoy. I could have watched these both sequences be twice as long and I would not have complained, because it's so fun to watch people at the top of their game like this. Even if Gene Kelly did you know, verbally abuse all of them to find the brilliance. There's a little bit of a Whiplash like scenario here. You know, if you've seen the movie Whiplash, there's sort of this question like, are the means to the end like morally justifiable in creating incredible art and like kind of squeezing art out of people that is beyond them? And I don't know. I don't know what the answer to that question is. Probably not if you're going to be a big fat jerk, but like the product that exists in this movie is something to behold, especially the dancing in these two scenes.
Isn't it kind of ironic too, because that whole romance that builds between Kelly and Reynolds' character is all it's played for very genuine, like, no, I just want to be decent to you. You bring out something good in me. And then you think, like, when the camera stops rolling and he's bringing out verbal and literal banana peels for Debbie to step on. Boy, that's just the industry, I guess, as we've discussed ad nauseum at this point.
And it's funny because, like, in 42nd Street, for instance, you get that sense that the backstage stuff bled into the movie more. Like, I don't know, like, And even in Sunset Boulevard, right? Like this movie in Sunset Boulevard essentially set out to tell a similar story. It's like we have a bunch of silent film people who are transitioning into talkies, and they don't know how to do it. They don't know what they're doing. They might be left behind. And this movie is just, you know, it's a wildly different genre of movie, but you got the same thing happening here. And so the stress and the, you know, immense pressure that everybody puts themselves under, and the fact that Gene Kelly had become this like auteur of the genre of, you know, putting dancing and musicals on film, it doesn't come through the movie at all. Like their chemistry is good. He is delightful to watch on screen, but it's funny that like there's this sharp divide between that and what was happening apparently behind the scenes, because you watch them on in Moses Supposes and Good Morning and you're like, oh man, they love each other, look how much fun they're having. And I think they were all in pain and suffering. The name of this song, Justin, is Singing in the Rain. People being in pain. Apparently he had a 103 degree fever when he danced this number, which is sounds terrible. And the water pressure in Los Angeles would not allow them to pour all the water necessary to make the effects happen. It's the weirdest scene to me in some ways, because, you know, his dancing is incredible. The song is fun. But like this looks like one of the most backlotty shot in a soundstage things in the whole movie. And it's not. That's a real street. They just blacked out like tons of other stuff around those buildings. They cut holes in the concrete in order to make the puddles big enough to show up. And like, I don't know. This is a crazy sequence. And the fact that he did it with a 100 degree fever in one take makes me feel bad for him.
Oh, I thought he did it. I thought it was a myth that he did it in one take. I thought it was over several days.
Okay. That I would believe that too, because look at it. I mean, goodness. I also heard a myth that I heard was a myth after I had heard it. That's the best way that could have been articulated.
Let me tell you this story. Wow, that's a great story. It's a myth, you know.
Thanks for telling me that they mixed milk in with the water in order to like have it show up on screen. And then the director was doing an interview with Diane Sawyer later that I watched. And he was like, no, that's not true. It was just water. And I was like, oh, okay. Why would someone make up that they put milk in the water? That's so weird.
Interview over at that point.
Yeah. Anything distinctive about this sequence that you want to point out other than the fact that he is singing in the rain?
What is better than this song? It's I mean, really I just good. Become annoying in my house after this movie's over, because all I want to do is go, I'm singing. You know, it just like it is such a good song. Yeah, it just so makes good. You want to sing and freaking tap dance your ass off. So that's all I want to do, man.
You need it. It's useful for sitting on.
It's contagious.
It's contagious.
Not that part.
Just like his flu or whatever he had at the moment.
And if the girl were I...
All right, so that one's called Would You. It's from the movie in the movie, and then, you know, what? She sings it at the end, right? Like, that's the big one that... Wait. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, though he sings it to her as she's trying to run out crying, and that's what gets her back. So it's a pretty song. I think it's pretty.
It's pretty.
Nicely sung.
That's what you get for listening to our podcast, folks. We'll play you songs and we'll tell you which ones are pretty.
Yeah.
And when you need to go to the bathroom.
Yes. Also there's an app for that called Run Go Pee, if you were wondering. So, if you
Run Go Pee?
Yeah. Something
how does an app help you when you have to take a leak?
Because you go to the movies and you pull up the movie on this app and it tells you at what point in the movie you should go take a pee break, cuz nothing's going
to
happen.
No one gets to tell me that. There's no good point. It's a movie, for crying out loud.
I know.
How are you going to tell? You know what? Yeah, that part, that we didn't need that at all. Yep. I am going to the bathroom now.
Well, also,
you're going to end up walking out on Schindler's List if you try to pull that crap, and I'm not going to let you back in to my theater.
Oh my
Darn
gosh.
It.
Okay, let's talk about Broadway Melody. It's the last real song in the show, and it's the most incredible, amazing, like 16-minute sequence in the whole movie, I think, because it just like goes and goes. The set pieces are crazy. The dancing's crazy. It's got that thing that the song from the movie 42nd Street had in the final number, Justin, where there's like, just looking at the set and the scope, like when they do that huge pullback shot of him under the spotlight and he becomes so tiny in the grand scheme of things, and the number of humans on camera in this sequence, not to mention the whole, like, you know, woman with the crazy long train where they dance on that weird like runway. It is like a feast for the eyes. It is so cool to look at, and I really liked it. I think it says a little bit about how like the industry was going to like push forward in all these interesting ways, right? So you got this one piece of it where he's like, I'm a guy going to Broadway. I got to go talk to a manager and see if I can get picked up and get some gigs. And then it just becomes other things, like transcendent, weird imagery of a guy and a girl on this long, ethereal, stair-steppy runway thing. And her dress is way too long and the dancing is gorgeous. And it's really cool. I liked it. What did you think?
It is really cool. I think you are the correct target audience for that. And so I'm not going to say that you're wrong, but I did not... But I don't think you're right. No, I'm just kidding. I just didn't think... It did not resonate as much with me for a couple reasons. One is I just found it kind of distracting. In the Broadway Melody sequence, he is like in this, you know, casino.
Yeah.
And there's the woman in the green dress.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's sort of flirtatious at first, kind of dancing or whatever. Right. And it kind of... It takes a turn. I mean, we're talking about 1952.
Sure.
So it's not like, you know, Dirty Dancing or something. But it's like, wow, there's some, I mean.
They get a little friendly. Yeah, they get a little friendly.
And apparently they got so friendly with some original cut of this movie that a couple organizations, including, I don't know if it was the Catholic Church at large, I forget now, or different Catholic organization, they're like, you have to cut some of this crap out of here. It's ruining the country. and so apparently they did.
Yes.
They cut some portion of that sequence out.
Did you see the cut? Because if you're watching that, see the dance in the casino part of that whole thing, there's this weird, it doesn't happen anywhere else in the movie. This movie is like so well edited, and like it moves from like moment to moment to moment without any little weird glitches like some old movies do. And there's a moment where he's like, they're very close and she's sort of like wrapped around him in a way. And then it just sort of goes skip. And then the song is over like 30 seconds later. That's apparently where they snipped out the actual like frames.
Yeah. Well, I found those frames that they did snip out. And what actually happened was Gene Kelly had a wardrobe malfunction and his pants fell off.
Yep. Well, that's
except it wasn't a wardrobe malfunction. So awkward. Yep.
Yeah. They were ripoff Velcro pants for some reason.
He was back to his vaudeville. He had the big polka dot boxers on underneath.
Exactly. Do you know what happened to the original print of this movie?
Oh, the original print. No. What happened, Travis?
It burned like in a fire in like the 70s at some point. So whatever that middle, contraband portion of that dance is, it's gone forever. No one will ever see it, which is
the Catholics got their wish.
They burned down the building to save the country. Yes.
So the other portion, which you talked about also, of the sort of ethereal, dreamlike paradise dance between Gene Kelly and Mystery Woman with Long Train.
Yes.
I was liking it at first, and then it kept going on, and I got less to hang on to.
Mm-hmm.
And so just for me, if I'm being honest, unfortunately, I was waiting for something to tell me like why I get this is supposed to be beautiful and they are dancing. What is this doing?
Yeah.
And so when that's kind of like one of the last pieces that sort of comes close to wrapping up the Broadway Melody. And then you realize you're still in the, like, it's all been a sequence kind of bookended by Gene Kelly's character telling the studio manager, RF, you know, hey, this is so what do you think of my idea? That's the idea. And RF says something like, I can't quite visualize it.
Yes.
And I thought, holy crap, RF, I just watched it and I can't quite visualize it. So I don't know if that was supposed to be commentary on that or what. More than likely, it's just a bit over my head, Travis.
Well,
because it sounds like you resonated with you.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, if you're the kind of person that might buy tickets to a ballet or a really dance heavy show and just enjoy it for that aspect, that's that 15 minute chunk, and it's long, you know, like it's a long number. It's like a number inside of a number inside of a number, like you said. And there are things to be appreciated in there, but I absolutely understand why it might not be for every single viewer. If you like Make 'Em Laugh and Singing in the Rain, you might not like totally jive with everything in Broadway Melody, because it's like largely unsung, and then lots of dancing and weird stuff. You brought up RF, and before we find our way to the finish line here, I just want to say, apparently, and this is, some of this is Wikipedia, IMDb trivia, so please take everything with a grain of salt, but it's an interesting idea, at least, to entertain.
Travis, never reveal our sources. Those are highly confidential.
They're gonna get assassinated. Apparently RF was based on a real studio executive of MGM, and the director in this movie, who is absolutely roid raging out of his mind in every sequence, was nice. Based on director Eric von Stroheim, Justin.
Oh my gosh.
So
really?
That's apparently, he was very like highly intense on set. And so
Yeah. This
is a played up caricature version for comedic effect, but like that has right. some ties to like, yeah, actually
oh,
a real
interesting.
Person, which is kind of interesting and fun. And yes, he's a literal cigar chomping studio executive. So should we put our own stamp of approval on this picture, Justin, and tell the people whether it was worth their time? Does that sound like a good idea?
I just put my stamp on it.
Why don't you go first, Justin?
Well, folks, I'll tell you what you get if you watch this movie. You'll get a picture from 1952 with plenty of color. You'll get Gene Kelly. You'll get Debbie Reynolds. You'll get Donald O'Connor. You'll get a lot of singing. You'll get a lot of dancing. You'll get a whole lot of fun. So strap in. Get a bucket of popcorn. Bring the kids. Bring the moose. Bring your enemies. And watch Singing in the Rain.
Okay.
What do you think, Travis?
I think, as we hinted at before, I think this movie grasps everything it's reaching for. I think it's really entertaining spectacle. I think the imagery is super striking, and there's some really iconic stuff in here, obviously. But I do think that there are some bits of substance to walk away with. Things like one generation of entertainers passing off the torch to the next, and careers being upended, and purely aesthetically, if you all are not into old movies, I don't know why you're listening to this podcast still, but if you are finding your entry point into old movies maybe difficult, or like, I don't know if I want to watch that one, it's in black and white, it's got subtitles, whatever your reasoning, if you like The Artist or La La Land, you have to watch this movie, because like half of the cool things you see in La La Land would never exist if this movie didn't exist. The leading man of The Artist, who's played by, what's the guy's name, Jean Desjardins or whatever, he's so clearly modeled after like this Gene Kelly. Like they look the same. And so I think the historical value of the movie is really there, but also it's just stinking entertaining. It's totally worth your time. I would watch this. I want to show it to my kids. I didn't have a chance to watch it with my kids, but I would definitely watch it with my kids and just sort of like, you know, send them to get me a glass of water during that sultry dance sequence, Justin.
And go get me a glass of water. Dad, there's three of us. Three glasses. What do I stutter? Freaking morons.
Tappity tap tap, Justin. We are through that whole big long sequence that you didn't like.
It wasn't that I didn't. You weren't listening to me.
No, I never listened okay. to you. Next week,
good.
We're going to look at something way different. It's called Forbidden Planet. It is a classic Cold War era sci-fi movie from 1956. I'm excited because the last one of these we did was a kick in the pants. Are you excited?
Yeah.
Okay, we will zoom to space next week. Bye.
Let the movie speak.
What? Lena, we're missing.
missing every other word. You've got to talk into the mic.
Well, I can't make love to a bush.
All right, all right. We'll have to think of something else.
Hey, since you're still here and still listening, thank you, by the way, we'd like to ask an additional favor of you.
We have social media. It's a thing on the internet. And all you need to do is find us on Instagram or Twitter or Facebook and like and subscribe. I know this is annoying, but we have to ask you because we want more people to hear the show. In addition to that, if you could rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen, we would greatly appreciate it. See you next week. Bye.